Here we are with Tim Versalotti, director of the Western New England University Poll, professor of political science, and a great guy. So let me ask you this, Tim. We haven't talked about Paul Ryan's retirement and what that means to the House.
Yeah, it was one of those things that had been talked about just quietly in the background. And whenever Ryan's staff would field questions from reporters, they would say, no, absolutely not. There's no talk of that occurring. And then Ryan announced that he would be leaving the House at the end of the current term. He said ostensibly that it was time to spend more time with his family. But in reality, the Speaker's job was not a job that he had sought. It's clearly not an easy job. And I think he was looking at the tea leaves in terms of the prospects of holding on to the House and thought this was a good time to go. Now, that does it does a few things. One, it could dampen his fundraising ability somewhat. He's a very successful fundraiser for Republican candidates for the House, and it was expected he would continue on that track for the rest of this cycle. He may be somewhat less in demand now that he's a lame duck. And it's also set off the expected jockeying among individuals who would like to succeed him. And Ryan is saying he's in the job till next January. There's no rush to choose a successor, and yet we see a lot of maneuvering behind the scenes.
And who are those candidates?
So there are a couple. The obvious potential successors are Kevin McCarthy of California, the House Majority Leader, who went after the job once before when John Boehner stepped down and could not put together the 218 votes that he needed. And then the third in seniority or in the pecking order in the House leadership, Steve Scalise of Louisiana, the House Majority Whip, is also said to be interested, although there's some speculation that he would defer to McCarthy if it came down to the two of them. What is the wild card is whether the most conservative collection of House Republicans, the House Freedom Caucus, would put forward someone to challenge for the speakership. That individual, in all likelihood, wouldn't have a shot of winning, but could be in a position to bargain for influence and some committee chairmanships for members of the caucus under the next speaker.
Leads me to the next question. The Democrats are counting on taking the House right now, and they've put out lists of endangered species we have here in our listening area, John Faso, Elise Stefanik, and some others. What's your assessment as to whether or not they're overthinking this?
It's a good question, and there was some speculation that Ryan was looking to the future as House Minority Leader and decided that wasn't a position he wanted to be in under President Trump, because what we have seen is that left to his own devices, the president will cut deals with Democrats until his staff reel him back in. And so should the Democrats take the House, it would put the House Republicans in a difficult position should the president decide to cut some deals. Now, the Democrats have to flip 24 seats to take the majority in the House. And in polling, we have what's called the generic ballot, where we ask individuals, if the election for the House of Representatives were held today, would you support a Democrat or a Republican? And that's often used as a predictor, and that's a fairly reliable one in many cycles, for the prospects of one party taking the House away from the other. The Democrats have seen a double-digit lead in that generic ballot, but in most recent polls, it has begun to close a little bit. The Real Clear Politics average at the time of our conversation here, it's about 6.5 points. And the speculation is it's got to be at least 7 in order for the Democrats to overcome the disadvantages that they face because of redistricting. The Republicans control more state legislatures. They did a very effective job of drawing House boundaries after the 2010 census. So the Democrats really have to pile up a majority in order to take back the House.
the assessment on the Senate is not nearly as rosy, right, for the Democrats?
It's certainly not. There are now 35 seats up, or ordinarily in this cycle there would be 33, but there are two elections to complete unexpired terms, one for Tad Cochran in Mississippi, who stepped down for health reasons, and the other for Al Franken in Minnesota, who stepped down after getting swept up in the allegations of sexual harassment. Of those 35 seats, Democrats have to defend 26. And many of them are seats that they won in swing states in 2012 when Obama was on the ballot. And in presidential election years, of course, you typically have higher Democratic turnout. So we've got some candidates, Claire McCaskill in Missouri, Joe Donnelly in Indiana, Heidi Heitkamp in North Dakota. Those are all states that went for Trump, Joe Manchin in West Virginia as well. And so they all have their hands full just holding on to their seats. So it would have to be an extraordinary wave for Democrats to pick up the seats they would need to take the Senate. It's a 51-49 Republican majority right now, but it's widely expected that the Democrats will have a net loss of seats in the Senate this year.
Wow. Richard Neal, appearing on this program quite frequently, now faces a primary challenger. My assessment is not much of a chance. What do you think?
Yeah, it's been an interesting race so far just to watch this dynamic, because Congressman Neal rarely gets a primary challenge, but he's facing one from a Springfield attorney, Tamira Amatul Wadud, who, 44, practicing in Springfield, but really barnstorming the district right now, saying that the constituents are settling for seniority over effectiveness. And she was recently campaigning in Pittsfield on the simple and straightforward issue of broadband access, which is still a real issue in the first district in western Massachusetts. And her argument is, even if the Democrats were to take the House, even if Congressman Neal were to win re-election and take on the chair of the House Ways and Means Committee, one of the most powerful positions in the House of Representatives, what will that mean for the first district in Massachusetts? Her argument is, don't be swayed by seniority. Find someone who's going to be effective for you in improving your everyday life. She badly trails him in fundraising. He's got more than $3 million in the bank. She's got about $22,000. So it may be a quixotic campaign, but it sure is a fun one to watch, just to watch the rhetoric and watch the issues that are coming up.
We only have a minute, but why in the world would anybody accept the logic that if your congressman is one of the guys who has the best chance of bringing home the bacon, why would you accept the logic that that somehow is bad?
Well, if you travel around the first district, and I'm thinking in particular the hill towns of western Hampshire County and then the communities in the Berkshires, there's the progressives, the sort of Bernie Sanders Democrats in those communities, are very frustrated with Richard Neal, that he's not taking time to meet with them in the district. He's not taking time to listen to their concerns. So those are the folks pushing back against this seniority argument. It's hard to see it getting enough traction that they would be able to put Neal in any real danger, but it's out there, and he does have to speak to it.
I got to say, he is my congressman in the first district. That's where I live, in Great Barrington, you know, and I only hear great things about him. So maybe we're talking to different people. But in any case, we've been talking to Tim Versalotti, director of the Western New England University poll, professor of political science, and one of the brightest men I know. Thank you so much, Tim, for being with us.
Happy to do it.